harping on wars we fight, griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my countrymen, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight beside me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and talking that deep. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man, you're walking on right beside me. Just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight beside me. Running down with life, I'm if you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You run down my country, man. You're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fight beside me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and falling down deep. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be warned. You run down my country, man, you walking on the right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fight inside of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Going to play the show, The Ethno State, which is which we record every Tuesday. That's William Johnson, the chairman of the American Freedom Party, Ken Givenan, myself, Paul Fromm, and usually another guest. And this is this week's show called How White Nationalists Support Each Other, and a lot of other topics as well.
Hello, everyone. This is William Johnson, chairman of the American Freedom Party, here with another edition of The Ethno State, here with the usual gang of suspects, Ken Givenan, Paul Fromm, and me. I've had a lot of interesting things that has transpired in the last half an hour, really. But in any event, I try to help out people wherever I can. And I've been on, I guess, on the radar for people that have been in prison for a variety of reasons. And they'll write me big old long letters, handwritten on both sides of a piece of paper, just lamenting their problems. And I always write them back, really kind of upbeat kind of stuff that your mother would write them, trying to get their lives in order. And a couple of times people have gotten their lives in order. Well, I got a call just 5 minutes before this show started, maybe 15 minutes before the show started, from a guy. He says, I just wanted to let you know, Mr. Johnson, that I'm doing really well. I'm in a drug rehab program. I'm out in a halfway house. And I got a job in a steel factory making conveyor belts. And then I've got a job lined up where I'm going to be training to work at an automotive motor plant, manufacturing plant. So I was just very pleased. And he says, I'm thankful for all that you did. I'm getting my life in order, and I'm going to try to find me a good wife, get married. So it was a very touching and uplifting story from somebody that I truly believe will turn his life around. Do you guys have experience like that where you see people who've had problems in their youth or in their middle age, and they come out of it and they become good citizens of the community?
We're thinking. one person I've been advising quasi-legally for 10 years, and this person just careens from one bad mistake and bad choice to another. So my limited experience in that area is not particularly positive.
No, that's true. That's true for most of them. But you get an occasional success story. And that makes, I guess, these prison ministries worthwhile, or these counselors that actually have an effect and do good. And so, yeah, I've counseled maybe 10 people legally, but of course I was throwing a lot of social advice as well. And of that 10, a couple or three of them have made significant progress. So it's encouraging, and that's what we need in society.
That's where there's perhaps a bit of a conflict between a very committed Christian and a conservative. Conservative tends to be a little bit more, maybe a little pessimistic, and a Christian has to have a virtue of hope. I guess a balance is probably good between just downright cynicism about everything and kind of Pollyanna hopefulness about everything. But my experience has been more on the negative side.
Well, also, you got to realize that my exposure to them is through letters and through telephone calls. I've not invited them into my home.
No.
If three of them turn out good, three of them are going to turn out equally very bad. And so you have to use discretion in that regard. But, you know, I'm encouraged.
Oh, that's good. Good news is always worthwhile these days. Why
yeah.
You're welcome.
Right.
I had a friend who was released from prison, apparently on some kind of drug charges, drug trafficking charges. And to help him out, I hired him to do work on my house. And after about 2 months, he disappeared. Left his tools, left a note, said, "Sorry, I gotta go." So apparently the cops were after him again. So.
Okay, yeah. Well, you have that famous story about Elizabeth Smart, who grew up in Salt Lake City as a 14-year-old, 13-year-old girl or whatever it was, and her do-gooder parents invited all these people in to help, you know, around the house, do their roof, and they invited some weird old guy who later on broke in, kidnapped the girl, and made her his slave and his wife, but she was like 14 years old for like a couple of years. You guys remember this story?
Vaguely, yeah.
Yeah, and so in any event, she guys was the victim of, I guess, Stockholm syndrome, and so she kind of became attached to him through psychological abuse, and they went around the country just hitchhiking, and she'd wear all these burkas because they were some sort of extreme Christian sect, and so she and everybody thought she was dead, didn't know where she was. She was a little 14-year-old girl, and then after 2 years, somebody was interviewing, you know, picking them up or whatever, and they said, "Hey, you know, this little girl, I think she's might be not really belong to this cult." And they found out that it was this Elizabeth Smart, and they saved her. She got back with her family. She grew up. She got married. She's got a couple of three kids now, and a very good success story. But the point that we all learn from that is you help these people from a distance. You don't invite them into your home where they can break into your house after hours and snatch your daughter.
Well, most of the people I've advised, though, are kind of different. They're political prisoners, and in most cases, they're in prison not because they've messed up their lives, but because they've crossed the beast. And, a good friend of mine, a medical doctor, Dr. James Seuss, may well end up going to jail in Canada for violating the hate law for putting out satirical newspaper, if that's under appeal. But those are the type of people I'm more involved with, so they're not quite the, you know, down and out types that you've dealt with.
Well, all of my contacts, they come through me through the movement. So guys, they are movement related people, or at least they found, you know, they found the white race through their involvement in prisons. And so they write me because I guess I'm a lawyer on a lot of their lists, I guess. And so that's why I do get contact. But no, I don't help anybody that hasn't come for me through the white nationalist movement. Another thing that happened, I got contacted by this group of people that are wanting to set up a U.S. operation of a internet newspaper and blog and all that kind of stuff. It's very active in Lebanon. And this referral came to me, had nothing to do with our movement. It just came across from business contacts. And they said that you know, Mr. Johnson, Lebanon is the most happening place for protests in the world right now. There's just a huge uprising. And so we have the best connections in the Middle East, and we want to start going forward and setting up operations here. We present our news in three languages, Arabic, English, and Russian. And we're going to be setting up operations here in the United States. They want to know, do you have the contacts? And they came for me, had no relationship with the white nationalist movement. And I said, well, I have a lot of contacts, but I don't know that the kind of contacts is going to help you move your thing forward. He said, well, because in addition to legal work, they wanted to have all of the political contacts. And it was just by happenstance that they came to me. They didn't know I was at political before they contacted me. But so we talked probably about 2 hours. Wow. And so I said, look, I've got contacts, but these are my contacts. You know, I am a nationalist. And like, for example, I was asked to do be a pundit and an expert, give expert advice for a Israeli news television station regarding white nationalism. So I called up the lawyer for Breitbart News, which is, his name was Joel Pollack. And I called him up and I said, hey, I'm going to be a pundit for Israeli news on this particular issue. What are the Jews, what do the Israelis think about this issue, so I can give the right opinion? And he says, oh, Johnson, I know who you are. You're American Freedom Party. You're a Nazi. Boom. And he hung up on me. So I told this person, Lebanon, that's the kind of contacts I get. People call me Nazis in my political views.
That's what I call the balanced judicial mind. That's the lawyer I want to have working for me in the emotional basket case.
I know, but see, Breitbart News is kind of really conservative. It's kind of like on our same page. So this took me out of the blue. I didn't expect that.
Breitbart
called
you a Nazi?
Yeah.
Well, then his last name is Jewish.
He is Jewish. He is Jewish. And I think I talked to him and said, oh, excuse me, right now, I'm taking my kids to the synagogue or whatever it was. I don't know what it was. So he's clearly an observant Jew. But I told this to the Lebanese guys. That I said, these are the connections I have. I put you in contact with people, but if you use my name, you're going to be tarred with a broad anti-white brush, right? I mean, tarred with an anti-American brush. So in any event, we talked further, and he was being real political. I said, well, what are your views? You want me to introduce you to people, but what's your views? Are you nationalist? Are you globalist? He says, oh, he was just giving some sort of political advice, position, saying, oh, we like American involvement in the proper manner. And I said, well, okay, look, let's cut to the chase. You give me all these wishy-washy views. What's your views on Israel? He goes, oh, there's two sides on all these stories.
And
I said, okay, well, you're being a politician now, you know, because everybody takes either one side or the other. No one's in the middle. He says, oh, we're in the middle. You know? That's what he said. So we went back and forth, and I was just telling him, hey, look, I'm a white nationalist. If you want to work with me, I'll work with you, but you got to know that my name, as small as it is, isn't going to get you anywhere. And so after we talked a long time, he says, you know, Mr. Johnson, I want to work with you. And so I was kind of flattered. I couldn't put him off. Maybe this little story about this Joel Pollack lawyer issue, maybe that kind of warmed his heart, because he didn't like that person anyway. But in any event, he told me, he says, you know, the most rioting, the most social uprising, the most disturbance that's taking place anywhere in the world right now is Lebanon. And I said, well, you got Hong Kong going on now, you got Barcelona and in Spain, or the Catalonia in Spain. You got a lot going on. He says, no, it's Lebanon. So I looked to see what was going on in Lebanon, and I kind of asked you guys if you knew what was going on there. And this is what I read. It says, for more than 9 days, the huge gathering of Muslim, Christian, secular, progressive, and religiously conservative people have served as a display of revolt that has jolted the country's political establishment. They're saying that protests came about after months of rapid economic deterioration, with increasing pressure straining the dollar-pegged Lebanese pound, and around a third of the country's population living under the poverty line and sinking deeper into destitution. So it seems to me that it is all driven by economics. And if these guys say that it is the most, anywhere in the country, in the world, it is the most opposition by the masses anywhere, that gives me pause to think. What can we learn from that in this country? Do we support them over there? Are we removed from them because they're Middle Easterner? How close are our ties with Lebanon? Do they like us? Do they dislike us? This guy certainly liked me after I listened to him for 2 hours. But what do you guys think?
Well, I read a little bit about that, but I'd be curious to know why the severe economic downturn in Lebanon. I don't really have a grasp on that, which is leading to this unhappiness and this protest. One thing I do know about the Lebanese political setup, it's extremely complicated. The president is always, I think, he's a Maronite Christian. The prime minister is always, I believe, a Sunni Muslim. Various groups are granted a certain number of seats in the Lebanese parliament. Like the Anglicans are granted one seat in the Senate. There are several seats devoted in the parliament to Armenians. Like every one of the various minorities and religious factions in Lebanon is guaranteed part of the pie. It's not like first past the post, whoever wins a plurality in the election has everything, and all the other guys are shut out. And so there's a constant jockeying. I'm not saying it's good or bad, but that is the reality. When I visited Lebanon with Lady Michelle Renouf a number of years ago, our accommodation was arranged for us by the one Anglican senator in the Lebanese Senate. But I think he played a dirty trick on us because he put us in the Muslim area. I think it's East Beirut, and I was awakened the first morning by horrible caterwauling at about 5 a.m. from a mosque that was 100 yards down from the hotel. But that's a minor problem.
Well, I wish I had had your understanding of Lebanese politics when I talked to this guy, because my only association with Lebanon, I guess I have two of them, is that I have represented a large Lebanese corporation for many years, and I was involved in his divorce, and I learned at that time that there's different divorce laws for the different religions that you have, and I had to work through that maybe 10 years ago, and so I knew a little bit about it. So I was pontificating. Lawyers always like to show how much they know, and I said, well, I know something about Lebanon. I know that the laws, for example, for divorce are divided up. You have divorce laws dealing with if you're a Christian, you have divorce laws if you're Muslim, you have divorce laws if you're Jewish. And he said, there's no Jews in Lebanon. And so I said, well, no, that's what the law said. He says, there are no Jews in Lebanon. And so he corrected me unequivocally. So I guess the laws don't deal with that particular sect.
Did you mean Druze or Jews?
Oh, that's what I
should. Jews are a very unusual group that are in Lebanon.
That's what I should have said. Oh, I misspoke. I meant Druze, not Jews. but even then, even with that gap, when I was trying to pontificate, they came across Flat. He still wants to deal with us. So that was encouraging. And then the other thing, I was in off, and a Lebanese family came up to me and they said, how do I get to this hotel? And it was right next to my office downtown. And so I said, well, I'll take you there. And I had a seven-seater. So I piled up this Lebanese family with a couple of adult kids and a couple of husband and wife, and I drove them all their luggage. I drove them right down to their hotel, and they said, you know, if you ever come to Lebanon, I want you to stay with us. And so I got his card somewhere. So if I ever make it over, if you and I ever make it over to Lebanon, we'll have a place to stay, but it probably will be in the Muslim quarter. So
if I visit Lebanon, I tell this guy my name is Bill Johnson, I get a free place to stay.
That's right, yeah. We'll get you over there. If this thing comes off and all these heavy influences in the Middle East bring us over to Lebanon, all three of us, to do a show, then we'll have a place to stay.
Do they need a Canadian correspondent?
We'll get you over there if we can. Let's get down to the articles at hand. The first one is, it's spooky.
Oh.
It turns out that white male terrorism in the USA is the most pressing issue in this country. Wow, I've learned something, Ken. What's that story all about?
This is a black congressional candidate in New York. Not surprising. His name is Jamail Bowman. And he says that the most pressing problem in the USA today is male white supremacy, and he's making the illusion of violence, terrorists. Now, this guy happens to be a middle school principal, from what I understand. And he's either very confused, or he's a liar. And as I was thinking about that, I thought, you know, if this guy is very confused, he should neither be a principal nor a congressman. But if he's a liar, he should be neither a principal nor a congressman. But what I think is happening here, and this should be kind of obvious, is he's just playing to his constituency.
Well, he's running for Congress, U.S. Congress?
U.S. House of Representatives, yeah.
Yeah. And is he likely to be elected? Is he running against an incumbent? Is it an open seat? Is probably not a Democratic stronghold. So the person who gets the Democratic nomination will probably be the one that sits in Congress.
I really didn't drill down on this to find that information, but Democratic congressional hopeful Jamail Bowman, I'm reading the story from freebeacon.com, ranked white male domestic terrorism as America's most urgent problem, while downplaying the issue of illegal immigration on Monday's appearance of something called the Hardy Report podcast. And here's what he said. There is no evidence that the crime in this country, particularly the heinous crime, is committed by our immigrant neighbors. So again, it's a false narrative, according to Bowman. The biggest issue in our country is white male domestic terrorism. That's the biggest issue. And that's what we need to deal with straight away. I'm trying to think of one incident in the last year that was committed by a white guy that could be even remotely considered terrorism.
To the extent that maybe he should be answered, I think he should be answered very aggressively. That's a lie, and that's racist, and that there are really very big issues facing the United States, the deteriorating infrastructure being one, and the tremendous menace posed to the United States by communist China, and the ongoing immigration invasion. Those are real issues. Angry white male terrorists.
I don't know what you guys are talking about. I can think of a number of examples of white terrorism, particularly that's racking the country right now. I mean, Adam Schiff, for example, that is the biggest terrorist activity out there. But I guess maybe because he's Jewish, maybe you're not considering him. But
he's not white. Okay,
there you go. But certainly terrorist. What he's doing is certainly terrorism. With this impeachment hearing, so yeah, I agree with I agree. candidate. In fact, I think I'll vote for it. Okay. But I was...
Another crazy Democrat from Orange County.
Yeah. Well,
do these people actually believe this? I mean, I can't believe for one moment that he believes what he's saying. He's got to know better.
No, indoctrination is a very real thing. And just like I mentioned that Elizabeth Smart was embraced, they had the Stockholm Syndrome, America, white middle class, is afflicted with the Stockholm Syndrome because we've had this concept pounded into us so much, we're afraid to wake up and you just can't do it. It grips us. I mean, I drive to work, and I've mentioned this many times before, through an area every day that has become gentrified over the last 10 years. And it went when I drive through, it was all Hispanic, and now there's a lot of substantial white families there with white children, and it's beautiful to see. And some of these old dilapidated buildings have been renovated, and there's like a coffee shop and really nice things where people can sit out. And then after this really hip coffee shop was set up, what did they write on the side of their building? Not graffiti, but a nice, beautiful sign that was as big as the side of the building, and it said, "Resist hate." And so, you know, all these white people are sitting down under this little big old sign on the wall, sipping their coffee with their little families, under the sign saying, "Resist hate." And you know what resist hate is. Where did that come from, Paul?
Well, that's one of the slogans of the Antifa.
That's an Antifa slogan, and the design is exactly like the Antifa slogan. So here, as soon as you get a gentrified white area, the first thing that happens is non-whites want to move in because they believe there's a constitutional right to live around white people. They all want to move into these areas. And the second thing that happens, the white people show their Stockholm Syndrome, and they start painting Antifa slogans on the side of the buildings, and they sit around drinking their $8 espresso underneath that sign. And so, I can't remember where I'm going with this, but it's a mess.
And if that is somehow meant to impress the remaining non-whites in the area, it doesn't, because there was, I'm involved, well, not involved, but in the city I live in, there is a problem with gentrification of older neighborhoods, and one of the things that happens is that the rents go up, and so the people that are, say, marginal in the area find it hard to continue to live, and there's resentment. So that sign, I would say, if anything, probably would just provoke people for what they would see as just utter hypocrisy, because they would see perhaps the presence of these yuppies as detrimental to their interests. These people are crazy. I'm not by that. I mean the people that put up signs.
Yeah. No, I don't have the same view on this as you do. I don't think they're trying to impress the remaining non-whites in the area. I think it's like, what do women say? That women don't dress for men, they dress for other women, you know? And so I think that this resist hate sign and these people that are embracing that, they're doing it to impress virtue signal to other white people. You know, they don't really care what the Spanish speaking, they don't even know what resist hate means. You know,
yeah.
It's all to impress the other white people. And it bugs me because, see, I would never shop at that store. I shopped there and got there before they put up that sign. The sign's been up there probably 2 years. And I've never shopped there since. Of course, I don't drink coffee. But I didn't get a muffin either. But it's just packed. And there's one that's a little shop that's older, about two blocks down. It was open when it just started to gentrify. And it doesn't have, and it's in a much better location. It's on a corner. It's a bigger, nicer place. And it doesn't have the resist hate on it. And it doesn't have the clientele either. So all these people that are working in Hollywood and moving into this area, they want a virtue signal with each other. And that's why they go to the resist hate shop. And so, but the actual concept, the word virtue or whatever the opposite of virtue is. And so it's something good to align around. So that, keeping that in mind, you had people on 4chan, which I don't look at. I've looked at it once and I can't follow it at all, so it's filthy. They have come up with a slogan that's down on your list, Ken. It says, it's okay to be white.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, it's okay to be white. That is as benign as resist hate is, or it's, you know, it's not confrontational, so I thought.
But it's considered hate.
Yeah, so what, tell us about that article, Ken.
Yeah.
Okay, let me get over to it here, make a couple of adjustments. And the story is of people putting up signs. This is one of the popular signs that's going up, it's okay to be white. Oklahoma City are investigating it as a hate crime, and here is what Summit.News has to say. Police in Oklahoma City are investigating it's okay to be white flyers that were posted at the Oklahoma City University School of Law as a potential hate crime. Although authorities acknowledge that the flyers are not believed to be a threat, and the posting them wasn't a crime because no property was damaged, the individual responsible is under investigation anyway. This is according to Associated Press. Investigators are trying to determine his intent. So they're not just brainwashing, but I guess they're trying to read our minds, mind readers.
This is so insane that they admit it was a free speech matter, that no crime had been committed. The words are not a threat. It's okay to be white doesn't say, you know, go and kill a black person or something. And they're still investigating? I mean, this is political police. This is the sort of thing that would go on in a banana republic. The United States has always been so admired because of the rule of law. Now here, there is no infraction of the law. The police should go and get a cop to the donuts. They should not be investigated. This is outrageous.
Well, I read an article about, I mean, this has taken place not only in Oklahoma.
Yes.
It's taken place recently in Massachusetts, and I think in Indiana, in your area, Ken. And I read the article about it being placed on Indiana. What I think has happened is they put on 4chan. They say, hey, you guys, on such and such a date, let's put up it's okay to be white signs. So other people read 4chan, a couple of people follow through on it, and they put them up. So it happened, I think, in Indianapolis, I think, or South Bend. And it happened in Oklahoma City, and it happened in Massachusetts, all at the same time. And I read the article about one in Indiana. It might not have been Indiana. It might have been Botswana or somewhere, I'm not sure. But in any event,
now that would be inflammatory in Botswana.
But the article that I read is that the college dean came out and said, this language is divisive. It's inflammatory. It's designed to divide peoples. Therefore, we must stop it and expel the student that we find out about it. So the concept of it's okay to be white, according to the administrator of this particular college, says it is so divisive, we got to take action. And that's kind of spooky.
What I take away from this is you got one guy with one flyer, one time, puts it on one pole, and the media picks up on it and spreads it to millions of people. So my goodness, it sounds like an excellent idea. You want to reach a million people with your message? Just print it out on the printer, one time, one pole, one place. You know, preferably college, university, because of how about it to the media.
Okay.
It's a wonderful idea, these memes. It's a franchise that's open to anybody. We had an incident like that in Toronto a couple of years ago on one of the campuses. There were a number of signs, I believe they said, it's all right to be white, or it's or what's wrong with being white, or something like that. That's all there was. Or no, I mean, maybe had a picture of a good-looking girl. There was an investigation, and the police were investigating. Nothing ever came of it. But the there's wild denunciations from the university administration that this was hate, and you know, the hysteria, I think, is the clash of ideologies. The cultural Marxists who essentially rule most of academia, much of the media, much of law enforcement, much of the control of law enforcement and the legal profession, this is heresy. I mean, they're fundamentally anti-white. That, I mean, that's the bottom line. The immigration, the engineered immigration invasion of North America and in Europe is to replace us. I mean, that you can put lipstick on the old whore, but that's exactly what it's all about. And any uprising, anything as benign as saying, well, we're okay too, you know, it's got to be denounced and slapped down. We've got to be kept permanently guilty until we finally give up and surrender to the invasion.
Yeah, every slightest little ember, Paul, they perceive as potential fire. So something as simple and benign as a sign, but you got to put that out quickly. I wonder what would happen, guys, if somebody would put up a white sheet of paper. Keep saying that.
there you go. I would like that's the next step. And then the college deans would come out and say, that's divisive. That's racist. Oh, that's funny.
We're being asked to play by rules that we don't exist for anybody else. If I say I'm proud of being European or proud of being white, well, I'm divisive. Really? But if somebody else says I'm proud of having male body parts, but I feel like a female, I'm supposed to say, well, you know, that's pretty good. I mean, you've got a right to be proud of being a mentally deranged. Or somebody says, I'm proud of being black. Well, I've got to say, well, yeah, we have tremendous achievements of your people for the last 50,000 years. That I recognize that. But if I say I'm proud to be European, I'm proud to be white, well, you know, I'm a monster.
But my biggest takeaway from this is the law school that it took place at. Ken, what law school was that again?
This was Oklahoma City University School of Law.
Do you know one of the most famous, best, top-of-the-line lawyers went to that university? Do you know who that is?
William Johnson.
No, I went to Harvard and Columbia. Oh. But it was our co-guest, Jason Robb. Jason Robb went to that law school. And I asked Jason Robb when I met him a few months ago at a rally, or at a church service, I guess it was. I says, well, you went to Oklahoma City law school. Did anybody hassle you because of who you are? As you know, Jason Robb is the son of the founder of the president of the Ku Klux Klan. I don't know if they call him president, but ever, the biggest Klan group in the nation, and he's their son, he's also involved in the Klan. And so I asked Jason, I said, did anybody find out who you were? You didn't know? He says, well, no. Nobody knew. It was never an issue, except in my third year. I was sitting in class with someone, and we were walking out the door, and he said to me, he said, hey, Jason, is your dad Tom Robb? And he said, yes, it is. He says, oh, that's interesting. And Jason says, why? He says, well, my uncle is something Moore or something like that. Yeah, Colonel Moore or something like that.
Oh, and, yeah, Colonel Moore.
And so, and he said, oh, you know. So there was immediate, it took him like 3 years before they recognized each other. But I think the last semester, they really had a lot to talk about. So,
in the dark here, who is Colonel Moore?
Colonel Jeff Moore was, I believe, became a colonel in the Korean War, and he did a lot of lecturing in the 70s and 80s. Is very strong against Jews and so on. That person, and he had quite a reputation.
Yeah,
he eventually got banned from Canada.
Yeah. Okay, but in any event, that's the story I have about Oklahoma City University School of Law, but now I got two of them based on this one. But this does bring up another thing, and I need to let you guys know this, is that I'm going to preface this by saying that my entire life, adult life, I've been involved in projects for the white race that always go nowhere. And so, and just as something starts to, you know, I never got enough projects to work on. So I decided to start a new project, and it's going to be, I'm going to write a play. And so, and I thought, and it's going to be a play, and it's going to be called, you know, it's going to be capitalized on the Donald Trump stuff. And I'm going to have two factions. I'm going to have the MAGA faction that'll be, you know, cheap props, because everyone's wearing a MAGA hat. And they're going to be, and under the sign that's going to say, it's okay to be white, you know, when in their meetings. And then the other side of the stage is going to have an Antifa information. I'll be dressed like Antifa with the ski masks and the hoodies. And then they're going to have a resist hate up there. So I'm going to put these two slogans out there as I formulate this play that'll probably never get produced. But that's another project I'm going to work on at 2 in the morning. And I'm going to highlight these two concepts, resist hate and it's okay to be white, and we'll see where it takes me.
The problem with that slogan, resist hate, is that the term hate is very, very vague. People mean different things by it. Most of us who are reasonably rational mean an unreasonable rage, you know, like the cartoon character who stubs his toe and gets so angry he smashes his fist into a wall, or wonders why his fingers are mangled. We see hate as irrational and bad. But hate for many people on the left is a defamation against us. If we don't want our country invaded, we're haters. If you don't want your kid or your grandchild exposed in a public library to some cross-dresser drag queen reading fairy tales to them, well, you're a hater.
That's exactly what that sign means. It means if you are MAGA, if you want to make America great again, you're a hater, and that's why it's very visible symbolism. And so I'm thinking things through, but you know, I just kind of talking off the top of my head now.
Well,
so in any event,
another point is, okay, everybody take a swig, but another point is they're giving them permission to hate us. Who says what did they say again? Hate is bad or whatever.
Resist hate?
No, resist hate. Yeah. What it means is resist white people or hate white people.
Yeah.
So it actually means the opposite of what it says.
Yeah. Many of their slogans, like inclusiveness. When you hear that an organization is working for greater inclusiveness, you better watch for your standing, because they want to get rid of you. We've got a taxpayer-funded committee for civic inclusiveness. Okay, that sounds pretty good. When I wanted to make it appear as a delegation before city council a few months back on a free speech issue, among other people who were lobbying that I not even be heard, was the Committee on Inclusiveness. I thought, the word inclusive obviously doesn't include me. It's like other words like diversity. Diversity sounds great. No, but our company should, or Mr. Johnson's law firm should have more diversity. What that would really mean would be fewer white people.
Yeah.
That goes back to what Bill was saying earlier, that this is a brainwashing technique. It's a thought-leading technique.
Yeah. Like, I remember a few years ago, many years ago, I represent a lot of large Pacific Rim corporations, and so I was asked to contribute to a Chinese American who was running for, treasurer in the state of California. So I made a contribution and thought nothing of it. And then he was starting to gain traction, and so people start investigating him, and they found out. That William Johnson contributed to this John Chang's campaign. And so they just jumped all over him. What are you doing taking money from a white nationalist and da-da-da-da-da-da? And so his campaign was just totally taken aback. And this is what they said. oh, we are going to return that money to Johnson immediately because our campaign is one of inclusion. And so
except for Mr. Johnson.
It just went so totally over their heads. They didn't get the irony of it. And they didn't get the irony.
True. I mean, that's what I think, but it doesn't seem to register. It seems like if you said when you left home in the morning, your wife, I love you, dear, but I'm leaving you. I mean, there's a contradiction here.
No, it's exactly true because my bank account increased by $250. They sent the money back. And so I was kind of happy, you know. Hey, Johnson's
coming to me. Because you gave to a Chinaman and you got the money back.
I got the money back. It was a win-win situation. And it made the news. So,
I had a similar incident when I ran for mayor. There were a few all candidates meetings, and one meeting was organized by the, Canadian Caribbean and Afro something or other organization. So they wanted to hear the mayoralty candidates. So I replied very politely. I was very honored to receive such an invitation, and I'd be very glad to attend, and I shall be there. A day later, I got a furious email. We found out who you really are and what you stand for, and our organization wants none of your hate, so you're uninvited. So I thought, hey, I've got the best of both worlds. I was polite, I was a gentleman, and I accepted an invitation in good faith, and then I didn't have to show up because it wouldn't be much fun.
Yeah. When they find out who we are, they really turn sour. Like, I ran many years ago to an open seat for Congress in Arizona, because you can run for Congress in any jurisdiction. You don't have to live in that state. Just at the time of the election, you have to be an inhabitant. You don't even have to be a citizen. You can just move there and the day before. So I run there. I decided to run for an open seat in Arizona because it wasn't too far away. And this was the time that Gabby Gifford was running, and she just got elected for the first time. And Gabby Gifford, do you guys know who she was? She was the congresswoman married to the, she was married to the astronaut, spent the longest time up in space.
And she was shot.
Was shot in the head, and she's still a little bit out of it, but she's mostly recovered. But in any event, I was running against her, so we were speaking. I was running as a Democrat at the time because I thought, you know, it was a seat that's held by Republicans, and I thought I was going to switch to a Democrat. And I thought that the Republican was going to keep running, and so it was going to be a safe seat for Republicans, and I would be able to run there. But it turns out he decided not to run again, so all the Democrats jumped in. And so I'd already filed my paperwork, spent a bunch of money, so I had to run. And so we'd appeared on a number of debate shows throughout Arizona, and I was on there, and I was really solicitous in helping Gabby Gifford get her microphone set up. I crawled underneath the table one time to make sure that the cables were all up and going, I was really treated with a lot of respect. And then the other shoe dropped. They found out who I was, and in the next debate, it was cold shoulder city. So you get that. Our reputation precedes us, and if it doesn't, when it does come to the forefront, we sure get ostracized. But it's interesting. The person that is helping us get over it is our President of the United States. Yeah. He said it initially, he says, you know, I'm taking all your slings and arrows for you so we can have a better country. And then my wife just told me that this morning, I don't know whether he tweeted this morning, but he says, you know, when I get up and face this opposition, it's just like, it's the same thing as getting on and putting on my suit and tie. I get up and put on my suit and tie every day, and I get faced with this opposition every day. It's just like putting on my shoes in the morning. I don't mind it at all. And so, if he can get it, he's nowhere near us on the revolutionary scale, but he gets calumny many times over more than we do. So if he can put up with it, then so can we. And it's helping to change the dialogue.
Well, the problem is, he's very clever. He has decided, and I think probably rightly, that most states will not change. And California and New York will be Democrat, et cetera. The presidential election will be decided in probably five states, Pennsylvania,
Michigan, Wisconsin, and maybe one other.
Florida?
Pardon?
Florida?
That's what he's targeting. And it's turning out that things that greatly outrage people in California, or lefties in California and New York, are going down very well in places like Michigan and Pennsylvania. And there's no great enthusiasm among his, among the blue collar workers who voted for him let's impeach Trump. There isn't. And this drama that's going on in Washington, I think in the end is going to help him. People are going to see that for what it was, a coup d'etat.
I know, he just moved to Florida. He changed his official residence to Florida.
Yeah, sure he did. But it's interesting to note that all of the pundits seem to be wrong. Of course, you know, they said, oh, if Donald Trump doesn't win Florida in the 2016 election, there's no path to there's no path to becoming president. And if you look at the final tally, it was a landslide. He totally thumped Hillary Clinton. But the media, Donald Trump has coined the term fake news, and it's really true. Like when he went to this wrestling match, whatever it was, and the big old news was that he was booed at the wrestling match. And you listen to it, and it's mostly cheers. So the media is just trying to stick it to him, and it's not working. He's becoming more and more popular, I believe. So
that's called the Trump thump.
The Trump thump or the Trump bump?
Well, the Trump bump is when you do a fist bump.
Oh.
It's a bit of an handshake. But you said he thumped Hillary, so I said, well, it's the Trump bump.
Oh, okay. I see. Yeah, all right. Okay, well, let's move on to another article. We've got...
We had two on hate flyers, so I don't know if you want to do the other one or not. But it's basically
okay.
The same thing.
Yeah, it's probably the same one. Let's go to the blacks and Democrats help cram Trump's rally in Tupelo. We're talking about Trump a little bit, so let's talk about that article.
This is according to the campaign manager. The guy's name is Brad Farscale, campaign manager for Trump 2020. He says in Tupelo, Mississippi, where Donald Trump recently had a campaign rally, they identified 16,432 voters. 24% voted once or less in the last four elections. 27% of those people, this is at the Trump rally, were Democrats. 20% of the people who were identified as voters at the rally were black. If they lose the black vote, they're going to have some serious problems. Now, I read some other statistics earlier in the week. 85% of black people say they're voting for Donald Trump. Just over 40%.
Wait, stop. 85% of the black people where?
No, I said that wrong. Are voting against Donald Trump. Sorry, I misspoke. Between just over 40% of middle-aged black males are voting for Trump. However, 93% of black females are voting against Trump. So the overwhelming majority of black females effectively said, we will vote for anybody. We don't care who the Democrats nominate. We're going to vote for the opponent of Donald Trump. We're going to vote against Trump, not for the Democrat. But still, if this calculation is correct, 20% of people who showed up in Tupelo, and that's overwhelmingly, black area, if those people are actually Trump backers, that could cause some serious problems for...
Well, I think he needs to really highlight Silk and what's that other gal's name? Silk and those two black ladies. One's called Silk and the other called something. They're big bloggers and they just love Donald Trump. And they're really kind of funny. But whatever.
And he's also had some good relations with and endorsements from, I believe he's a singer who's quite popular, Kanye West.
Oh, he has?
You call that singing?
Well, I've seen,
I'm using the term very loosely.
Very loosely, yeah.
But Kanye West has come out with like a big Christian album. I don't know where that's
from. Yes, apparently very recently.
So that's interesting. If Kanye West gets on the Trump bandwagon, that will be a big thing. But one thing that I've noticed is that if you take a look at the rallies over the years, if you take a look at the Bill Clinton rallies and the back behind him, you have all sorts of various multiracial or various races of people in the background that you see. And this is all designed. It's all planned. And when you have Hillary Clinton, the same way, all colors of the rainbow. And all of these politicians, whether it's senators, congressmen, they always stage it so that you have various races of people in view supporting the candidate. And if you look at all of Donald Trump's people behind him, they're all white. They're all white. You know, they're most of the time. And I've noticed on a number of occasions. So either he doesn't care or he says, let's just make it natural. And so that's a good sign, I think.
I was watching a newscast of Hillary Clinton somewhere in Texas. She was having a book signing event with her daughter. What's her name?
Chelsea.
And there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people standing in line. And I was watching these people as the camera spanned them. I didn't see anybody who was not white. I saw no Hispanics. I saw no black people. And probably 70% of them were women, you know, kind of the Hillary-looking types with a pantsuit and funny hair. What's this she's drawing? And this is in Texas. There are a huge, I don't know what percentage is, probably 40-50% are Hispanic. They're not, you know, it's white people. And Bill has made this point so many times. In fact, we kind of started the show with it. That, you know, the terrorists, so to speak, quote, unquote, people who are really hurting white people are white people.
Yeah, that actually surprises me. Maybe, I guess, one of the qualifications for buying a book is you have to be able to read it. And so maybe that's why it eliminates that population.
Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the Fighting Side of Me. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is a pre-painted in the day, in the morning, 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever.
In from Britain, shore, was the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple